Now, everything regarding man's relationship with God was under a covenant in the Old Testament. There's actually several covenants, but one in particular, we're talking about the Old Covenant, the Mosaic Law. With the sacrificial death of Christ, he established a new covenant that removes the old system altogether. The old covenant. You know, it always amazes me how much people in the new covenant want to keep doing things in the old covenant. You don't have to. And as I've said before, how many of you were born under the old covenant? That's right. None of you. Now, some people were Jews and they were born. None of you. Now, the main point of what we are saying is this. We do have such a high priest. Remember Christ in the order of Melchizedek last week? Who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, and who serves in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by a mere human being. Every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices, and so it was necessary for this one also to have something to offer. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest, for there are already priests who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. They serve at a sanctuary that is a copy in shadow of what is in heaven. This is why Moses was warned when he was about to build the tabernacle, see to it that you make everything according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. But in fact, the ministry of Jesus has received is as superior to theirs as the covenant of which he is mediator is superior to the old one, since the new covenant is established on better promises. So he's making this transition here from Christ being in the order of Melchizedek, having a better priesthood, to having a better covenant. Remember, the book of Hebrews is all about better. Jesus is better than angels. He's better than Moses. He's got a better covenant, better sacrifice, better priesthood. Better, 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 better. So why would you go to the other one? Well, you must go with the new covenant. Number one, because there's a better high priest in it. So the things he mentions are he's sinless. The other thing is he's seated. You know, the high priests don't sit down until their work's done, right? They don't. In the middle of doing the sacrifices, they don't get to sit down. Well, Jesus, the author wants to see, he's seated. He's not still doing his sacrifice. The other thing, he's enthroned. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool forever. You got to sit down to have a footstool too. Don't forget that one. It's hard to use a footstool while you're still standing. And he's a king. Only in the order of Melchizedek could be high priest and a king. So this first section is kind of review. We'll speed through it. There's a better tabernacle. That's why you need the new covenant. Christ could not be an earthly priest because the Levites had that role. If Jesus would have gone in to offer sacrifices in the earthly temple, that would have been a big problem. Because he wasn't a priest when he was on earth, other than what he does at the cross. The earthly tabernacle is a shadow of the heavenly one, it says here. The one Moses made was based on a vision of heaven. Moses didn't just receive verbal instructions on how to build the tabernacle, that is. So he saw something of which he was to make an earthly copy. And that's taken from Exodus 25:40. Jesus doesn't work in the earthly copy. He doesn't work in the shadow. He works in the original, the real thing. That's where he is. He has a better offering. We're going to look at that in depth in the next chapter. Skip it here. He's a better mediator. Moses was a mediator, but he wasn't the best. Jesus is. Perfectly representing both God and man because he's both God and man. Perfectly upholding the obligations of both, the justice of God, the love of God, but also the obligations that man has to God. And then there's this better covenant. How could he be a perfect priest if he didn't have a better covenant to work with? You know, that's the thing. If you don't have something better to offer as a covenant, then you may have a good sacrifice and all, but what are you giving us anyway? And better promises. You are priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. We've gone into that at length. So let's get to point number two. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah, will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord." You need a covenant you can count on. You can't trust the old covenant. Can't trust it. because there was something wrong with it. And Jesus didn't come and just patch up the old one. Oh yeah, a couple little flaws. Let me clarify a couple of things. Oh, now it's okay. Some people treat their Christianity that way. They want to live the Old Testament law, and then they want to take a few things. Oh, well, Jesus made it a little clearer for us, so we'll just keep going with that. Or they take everything that Jesus was teaching in the Sermon on the Mount and saying, well, that's for the millennial kingdom. What? You either want to change everything Jesus says or make it not applicable. How can you do that? Crazy. There was something wrong with it. So God makes a brand new one, a different one. You don't make a new one when the old one's perfect. That would be taking a step backwards. Well, what was wrong with it? Well, people. People. The problem was a human problem. The fault, it says, is with the people. When Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, everything the Lord has said we will do. So Moses is there. Here's the covenant for you. And again, we're not talking from Exodus to Deuteronomy. We're talking this chapter and a half there in Exodus. And they said, oh, we'll do it all. And so Moses writes down everything the Lord has said. He got up early the next morning. He built an altar at the foot of the mountain and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men. And they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he splashed against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it to the people. They responded, we will do everything the Lord has said. We will obey. Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. They cut a covenant with God and they reneged. But later, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Go ahead, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices, and go ahead and eat the meat yourself. For when I brought your ancestors out of Egypt and I spoke to them, I did not just give them commands about burnt offerings and sacrifices, but I gave them this command, obey me, and I will be your God, and you will be my people. Walk in obedience to all I command you, that it may go well with you. But they did not listen or pay attention. Instead, they followed the stubborn inclinations of their evil hearts. They went backward and not forward. From the time your ancestors left Egypt until now, day after day, again and again, I sent you my servants, the prophets, but they did not listen to me or pay attention. They were stiff-necked and did more evil than their ancestors. Didn't work out. God had shown the people kindness, it says in verse 9. He had brought them out of slavery. He took them by the hand, and they wouldn't follow him. Romans 7. So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, righteous, and good. He's talking about the Old Testament law. Was there anything wrong with it? Paul says, no, that wasn't where the problem was. Did that which is good then become death to me? By no means. Nevertheless, in order that sin might be recognized as sin, it used what is good to bring about my death, so that through the commandment sin might become utterly sinful. So what Paul is trying to say there is, sin is so ugly within you, it can take something good, like a commandment from God, and make ugliness happen in your life. Because of rebellion, God turned away from the people. He abandoned them and ignored them. You can't trust the old covenant because the old one was obsolete and aging. It's occurred when God created a new one. As soon as he created the new one, the old one didn't matter anymore. It was at that moment. When Jesus dies on the cross, there's this new covenant established. Not in the blood of bulls and goats and everything else. Not like the one where it was sprinkled half the blood on the altar and half the blood on the people. This was done in the blood of Christ. A new covenant. This one goes on forever. Why would you go on with the old covenant? It's what the author can't grasp. It's like when sometimes I tell you what some people believe and I just can't get my mind around it. I can't follow the reasoning to get there. I think that's how this author feels. He said, you've come to Christ and somehow you're wanting to go back to what is over with? No one should even consider going to what is disappearing. After the temple was destroyed in AD 70, according to Jesus' prophecy, it's never been rebuilt. There's no temple to go back to. You can't even keep the old covenant properly. It's another thing. When people think, oh, well, I follow the old covenant. You do? Which parts? Because you certainly can follow all of it. Oh, well, I just follow the moral parts of it. Because there's two parts. There's the moral parts, the commandments, and then there's the cultic part. By that, I don't mean it's a cult. I'm just talking in the language that you guys should understand by now. I'm talking about the part that involves the sacrifices, the priesthood. The priesthood we've been able to jettison, but we'll just keep the moral parts. Sorry, that's not how God intended you to do it. Good that you're doing the moral part. But if you want to keep the law, you've got to keep all of it. Don't tell me you're keeping it well. The temple, you remember in Jesus' day, and even if this book is written for before the destruction of the temple, the temple's virtually brand new. I want you to understand that. This is not Solomon's temple. This is not the temple that the exiles built when they returned. This is Herod's temple. It's brand new. It's brand new, and it's big. It's absolutely phenomenally huge. And Jesus is saying, yeah, every stone will be torn down. Inconceivable to them that it would happen so quickly. But it would disappear from their eyes. You can imagine that. If you've been to Jerusalem and you saw that, and then you came and visited again, and it was gone. No one should seek God through an obsolete or insufficient system. You benefit with the new covenant, though. Laws are put in the minds and written on hearts. The new covenant is inward. It changes minds and hearts. If it changes minds and hearts, the point is it's located on the value system. I mean, how do you describe your heart? Do you think if we cut you open and looked at your heart, in fact, the word heart, okay, it's different in the Greek, but the Hebrew word for heart isn't the Greek word for heart, and the word we use for heart. They use different internal organs, like kidney. Write this on my kidneys. Okay, no, none of these things. We're talking virtually here, the mind and heart, your value system. You know, it's not just committing something to memory. You can memorize laws. You can memorize rules. I mean, they were supposed to know it. But when values are transformed, you don't need any law. I think this is one of the things that's so fascinating to me. You know, I really have bought into what I teach. I only use this one guideline in my Christian faith. Sacrificial love for benefit of others. I don't do it perfectly. I fail all the time. But I don't worry about all the other things people think I should be doing in terms of my Christian life. And you know what? It doesn't bother me at all. I am guilt-free. It's like eating sugar-free, chocolate-free, whatever. I got no guilt. I just don't experience it. I don't know if that's your experience yet. I would hope you get to that point of freedom. You never need to experience guilt, number one, if you're trying to do the right things. And then number two, knowing that Christ forgives you, even when you don't. There's one rule in the kingdom, and there's a consequence for breaking the rule. What's the one rule of the kingdom? Sacrificial love for the benefit of others. And what's the consequence of breaking that rule? The consequence of breaking the rule is forgiveness. And it applies equally to the king as everyone else. He's obligated to forgive you. He has to do it. It's just, there's nothing like it. There's nothing like the freedom this theology can produce within a person. I was talking to someone, and we were comparing, you know, what I teach, sacrificial love for the benefit of others, with the philosophy of Buddhism. Because they were remarking on the similarity in terms of if anything's bad to you, don't do it to somebody else. I mean, that's just Judaism. So you go back to 6th century BC. It's got nothing on the Jews anyway. They were saying the same thing. Whatever you don't like done to you, don't do to somebody else. But what Jesus comes along and flips everything on its head and he says, sorry, that's just apathy. All right, you don't hurt people. Okay, you're not exploiting them. Very good. Golf clap for you. All right, and then we come over here and then you have apathy. Well, I'm not hurting you, so, you know, everything's fine. No, Jesus says, not fine. He obligates his disciples to help other people, specifically within the community. You can help those outside the community, but you have to be careful of being exploited by those outside the community. within the community, you have to love one another. And that's what he obligates us to do. If you want his love, you want his forgiveness, you have to give it to other people in the community, or you aren't in it. Simple as that. The old covenant was outward, it was external. It could declare God's moral will to the people, but it couldn't make anybody do it. It didn't provide the power to do it for people. Romans 3:20. Therefore, no one will be declared righteous in God's sight by the works of the law. Rather, through the law, we become conscious of sin. Nobody can look at the old covenant, the old law, read through it completely, honestly, understanding the words, and come away saying, yeah, I'm doing all right. Because you're not doing all right. You will fall. And I only need a couple of the Ten Commandments to doom you. You know that. Romans 8:3. For what the law was powerless to do because it was weakened by the flesh. And there's the crucial issue. Sin, the flesh, you can't do it. You need to be born again. You need to be changed. You need a new nature. You need your value system changed. Jesus provides transformation. His divine power has given us everything we need for a godly life through our knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and goodness. Through these, he has given us his very great and precious promises, so that through them you may participate in the divine nature, having escaped the corruption in the world caused by evil desires. You change. What do you think it means to participate in the divine nature? You don't become God, but you become his child. You're born again spiritually. And along with that comes this transformation of value system. Very powerful. Ezekiel 36, I'll sprinkle clean water on you and you will be clean. I'll cleanse you from all your impurities and from all your idols. I'll give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Then you will live in the land I gave your ancestors. You will be my people and I will be your God. See, the problem was the inside. The old covenant couldn't fix that. We don't follow a list of rules written on stone. We're to learn what love is and practice it. One rule. So simple. The doing it's the hard part. To attempt to be justified by observing the law doesn't work. It's just legalism. Paul says it's a fall from grace. He says to the Galatians, you who are trying to be justified by the law have been alienated from Christ. You've fallen away from grace. As soon as you go back to trying to do the law to please God, you've left Jesus. The saddest thing a Christian can do. Saddest thing. But if you seek the one rule of the kingdom, you participate in the new covenant, the perfect covenant, the way it was intended to do, to be lived. Not of works, but inner transformation. Not rules, but just loving others like Christ did. God will be the God of his people. This is verse 10. In essence, this is not really a new idea. God took the people to be his own people under the old covenant. But with further revelation of who God is comes a deeper understanding of what it means to be his. They weren't just his as opposed to people who weren't his. They weren't just his in so far as they were, God was obligated to take care of them and win their wars. The acts of God on our behalf or for salvation. For us, we understand the life, the death, the resurrection, ascension of Christ. If you don't know those things, you don't know God. You don't understand him. You don't understand what was going on at the cross. Your adoption, glorification, justification, sanctification, filling with the Spirit, all these things, part of what it means to know him. We're also more like him because of the work of the Spirit, something that God does in the New Testament in a different way. We're truly his children in a deeper sense. We know him because we're like him, John says. We're like him in this world. See, if you aren't like him, you don't know him. Those the people who say they know God who don't live like him don't know him. We have a relationship because we share his value system in ways the law could never allow us to do. What we see in Jesus is so far superior to what we see in the law that there's no comparison to it. It just isn't even in the same category. Which would you rather be like? Jesus, or somebody who perfectly does the Old Testament law? Okay. Now, anybody who picks this one over here, I have a few parts of the law I'd like to show to you. I'd rather be like Jesus than perfectly do the law. There's absolutely no comparison. The new covenant, you get to know the Lord. This does not mean that there are no teachers. It means that the knowledge of God is not going to be limited to a privileged few. Just the priests, just the prophets. Everyone can know him. Part of the new covenant is knowing God yourself. It's because God is most revealed at the cross. You cannot participate in the new covenant without the cross. Therefore, you have Christ's example in a way you can't deny. The old covenant, the people had the problem of forgetting God over and over and over again. But the believer doesn't have that problem. Here's what it says in Judges. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who neither knew the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. One generation away. The believer knows this is known by God. Galatians 4:9. But now that you know God, and then I like he clarifies it, or rather are known by God. 1 Corinthians 8:3. But whoever loves God is known by God. 13:12. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. You know, the whole concept of knowing is relationship. It's all relationship language. It's all it's about. You can't say you know God without referring to the idea of relationship. Some people do. For them, knowing God is having all the theology correct. But it's not. It's about the relationship that you enter into, not based on law or legalism. Once you truly understand what relationship with Christ is, though, you can't go back to law or legalism. There's just no real room for it. Deeply embracing the value system of Christ is to know him, and to reject Christ is to reject his value system. You can't have it both ways. To leave Christ would be to leave love, to embrace exploitation or at least apathy. Christ and his value system are inseparable. You can't have one without the other. You need Christ to truly see the value system in action. Without the death of Christ on the cross, God becoming man to die for his creation, God the Son being cut off from relationship with God the Father, the ideas of both these relationships, one being damaged to restore the other at infinite cost, you just begin to understand sacrificial love. There's no means to fully explain it without the example of God, of Christ. You need Christ if you want his power to do it. It's like walking on water. Good luck with that. You can do it partially, but only partially. Because faith is required to do it for God. This is where the distinction is. You can teach non-Christians to love one another, and you can teach them the value system of God. And they can do it to an extent. But for Christians, there's an added dimension where we receive power from God to do it because of the issue of faith. You believe in a God who raises the dead. So you can take sacrifice to a much further extreme than anyone else. You believe that there is a God who will reward you one day. You can take sacrifice to a farther extent than they can. Not that that's required. I hope the idea of reward is not the requirement for you to sacrifice. If it is, you're still looking out for number one. And you still don't understand sacrificial love. What else is in here? God forgives wickedness and keeps no record of sin. Ain't that great? Now, God forgave people in the old covenant. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. You just were wishing I'd close that quote off a little earlier, right? Like right in there. This is where Moses is saying, God, show me what you look like. God takes Moses and he says, you can't see my face, but I'll show you my back. And he sticks Moses in a hole in the rock and puts his hand over him, covers by. Moses looks out and sees the back of God. Yes, God is gracious, and God is choosing and electing, but that's the back of God. The front of God we see in Jesus. The assurance of forgiveness is written in the covenant. Our being forgiven in the New Testament is legally binding on God in his own blood. There's no more sacrifices, because one sacrifice finally removes the problem of sin. There's no more focus on sin. How often, I mean, other than when I'm teaching this, how often do I even talk about sin? I don't want to do that. I don't see the need for that. I just have to say sacrificial love, teach you that. You'll have all the motivation you have right there. I guess that's why I don't feel guilt. I don't think in terms of sin. For me, I think in terms of righteousness. It's all you look at. If you think about sin, you're focusing on what's negative, what you shouldn't do. Focus on righteousness. What is righteousness? Doing the value system of God. That's what righteousness is. That's what holiness is. Righteousness is doing God's value system. That's all it is. You do that, you're righteous. So there's no guilt when God removes your sin once and for all. There's no feeling guilty. There's only seeking to be more like him in this world without the pressure that comes from law. Relationship is different. See, when there's a pressure of following rules, it's not the same kind of relationship we have that's one based on love and friendship. It's not at all. But you must receive the new covenant. The use of the term new implies a continuation of the concept of covenant. Even though God changed the covenant, he did not go to something different. He said, oh, let's do away with covenant. No, he stayed with the idea of covenant. He just made a new one. We see this at the Last Supper. Jesus takes the cup, gave thanks, and he gave it to them saying, drink from it, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. You see this again in Luke and Corinthians. Very, very significant and important. We're also ministers of the new covenant. He's made us competent as ministers of a new covenant, not of the letter, but of the Spirit. For the letter kills. He's talking about the law, but the Spirit gives life. If you go around trying to get people to do the old covenant as a Christian, you're completely off base. You are to be a representative of the new covenant, not the old covenant. Did Jesus' sacrifice have the intended effect of the promised new covenant? What we read about in Jeremiah and Ezekiel? Well, let's see. Therefore, there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit who gives life has set you free from the law of sin and death. For what the law was powerless to do because it was weakened by the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh to be a sin offering. And so he condemned sin in the flesh in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fully met in us who do not live according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. I guess God managed to work it all out, didn't he? Let me finish. Every changed life is proof that there's no condemnation. No Christian should feel this. Lots of Christians feel it. Lots of Christians live it. Part it's just coming, first of all, to grasp really what you have in your faith. Really. If you feel condemnation and guilt, well, either you, I mean, maybe you really do deserve the guilt, but you can get past that. There's no burden of law. I don't focus on the Ten Commandments here. They're not listed anywhere in our building. I don't hang it up as a plaque. Now, if you do that in your house, it's okay. All right, I'm not criticizing that. I'm so likely to be criticized accidentally, unintentionally. I'm not criticizing you. There's good things in the Ten Commandments. They're not for you. Keep them, sort of. I'm a little iffy on that, keeping the Sabbath day. Because, you know, what did you do yesterday? All right, get the Sabbath day right, in other words. There's no fear of death. Christians should never have a fear of death. That's something you can't overcome. It's called faith. It's really believing what you believe. It's one of the most important things. We believe in a God who raises the dead. One of the fundamental aspects to our faith. and there's transformation to Christ-likeness. This is the number one proof. The number one proof. Nothing like this one. Jesus can change you. He can make you love in a way you've never loved before. That's the number one proof of the new covenant. Absolutely. You cannot beat that one. You just can't.